Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a student-led podcast of the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. I am Leila Olukoga, your host for this episode. We are joined today by one of the world's most experienced diplomats, Ambassador Juan José Gómez Camacho of Mexico. Ambassador Gómez Camacho has represented his country as ambassador to 8 countries and led international negotiating efforts on a wide range of issues, ranging from politics, economics, and trade to security, disarmament, humanitarian issues, and a host of other subjects. Ambassador Gómez Camacho holds a BA in law from Universidad Iberoamericana in Mexico City and an LLM in international law from Georgetown University. Our discussion explores these topics of international negotiations and international human rights law that he's been instrumental in, the fundamentals of multilateral diplomacy, and the impacts of domestic issues on international treaty compliance. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for joining us on the Small World, Big Problems podcast today.
Pleasure.
I just want to start by saying that your diplomatic career is extraordinary in its breadth and variety. In your 34-year career as a Mexican diplomat, you've served as ambassador to Canada, the United Nations, the European Union, Belgium, Luxembourg, Singapore, Myanmar, and Brunei. Reflecting on all of those experiences, what were some of the greatest challenges in relating to so many diverse cultures and representing Mexico in them? And how did you balance economic interests, political priorities, and humanitarian concerns?
Maybe my answer will surprise you, but I think the biggest challenge of a diplomat in general is understanding well his or her own country. A good diplomat, regardless whether he's serving in Geneva, in the UN, or in Singapore, or in any other place, has to have a very deep understanding of its own country or his or her own country. It's not only about following what the government wants you to say or wants you to do. A good diplomat can't be just a remote-controlled mouthpiece. A good diplomat is the one that understands deeply the needs of his country, the challenges of his country, the objectives of his country, of course, and then how to work for those interests in whatever place you are posted or deployed. So to me, back to your question, that has always been my most complex, committed, and interesting priority. Second, yeah, I think one of the most fascinating aspects of life as a diplomat, because you can have people that in a temporary way performs diplomatic duties, is appointed as an ambassador by a president, or goes to an embassy, or is a negotiator for this or that. That happens everywhere, the U.S., Mexico, in every country. That's a priority and the prerogative of any president or prime minister, and that's not only fine, it's necessary. But a diplomat, professional career diplomat, is a little bit different. A diplomat, career diplomat, like myself, is someone that has decided devote all his professional life to the service of his country. He's more closer to a military than anything else. I always say that diplomacy is not a job, but it's a way of life. And representing and working for your country is a way of life. And one of the most exciting things of this way of life is precisely the incredible diversity of challenges that you have to face. One thing is being ambassador in Singapore or being ambassador in the international organizations in Geneva, as I was, or in the European Union or in the UN or in Canada. They all have different aspects, totally different challenges, different roles, and different needs. So the other part of the answer to your question is that you have to develop the capacity to do it. A good diplomat can be a monothematic individual. It has to be someone that has the capacity of understanding, seriously understanding, deeply, with a really good degree of capacity, if you like, and completely a great diversity of unrelated issues. And that's a big challenge, but that's what makes this life absolutely fascinating and interesting.
Thank you so much for that thoughtful response, especially how you mentioned devoting your professional life to serving the needs of the people. Having worked on a wide range of contentious issues such as migration, disarmament, trade, how do you approach negotiations that involve actors with conflicting interests? Many of our listeners aspire to a diplomatic career or perhaps are already in the midst of one. So are there any diplomatic strategies or principles you've found consistently effective?
Let me, if I may, change a little bit your question. There's no negotiation if there are not conflicting interests. You see? If there are not conflicting interests, you don't need to negotiate. So negotiations are about conflicting interests or difference of interests by definition. That doesn't make it bad. It's just what it is. I was just leaving my class and we were discussing some of that. And I was saying that diplomacy was not invented to make friends talk to each other. You don't need someone to convince you and to help you and to negotiate with someone that is your friend. No, to talk to another person that is your friend. Diplomats and negotiations are between those that disagree, those that have different views, our conflicted interests, as you say. To me, the most fundamental rule, if you like, or principle in a negotiation is to understand that a negotiation, a true negotiation, that aspires to find long-term solutions to common problems, is one that has the capacity, the negotiators have the capacity, to create value for everyone. A negotiation is not like buying tomatoes in the market or buying a carpet in a bazaar, where it's a give and take. A negotiation is not one where someone has to lose something. A negotiation is one, a successful negotiator and a negotiation is one that understands the needs of everybody or every party involved and has the capacity to find a solution that is collective and that addresses each of the parties' needs and concerns. And that demands creativity. That demands imagination, that demands thorough preparation, and that demands also instinct, and it demands understanding that negotiators are people, not countries, and that you are dealing with human nature, and that as such, we need to understand all these, let's say, characteristics, and that allows you to build value for everyone. That's, to me, the main, most fundamental principle, at least, that I believe in and that I always followed and I think successfully.
Well, thank you so much for that insight. You mentioned the need to understand and apply long-term solutions to common problems. And I know a contentious issue right now is the issue of migration, specifically in the U.S., but also internationally. And from 2016 to 2019, you served as one of the two co-chairs who led the drafting and adoption process of the United Nations Global Compact for Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration, which, for listeners who don't know, was the first intergovernmental agreement to cover all dimensions of international migration holistically and comprehensively. So reflecting on the outlines and implementation of this agreement that you worked on, do you believe that it has been effective in advancing human rights law for migrants globally?
First, I should say that the Global Compact is not only about human rights. Human rights are always there, and there are many instruments that protect the human rights of migrants. You don't need a specific instrument for that. What the Global Compact does, and you're quite right in saying that is the first, not only the first intergovernmental, more than the first intergovernmental instrument, is the first global understanding on migration. And what it does is that we all, with some exceptions, but the vast majority of the UN membership agreed that on migration, first, migration is one of the most complex collective challenges that we face, and we should pursue three main objectives, regardless of whether we are a country, a rich country that receives migration, or a poorer country that sends migration. And these three objectives are that migration has to be orderly, that implies many things. That has to be safe, that implies also many things. And that has to be regular, which in other words means legal. Overall, what is interesting, and back to your question, what is interesting of this is that we succeeded to get this instrument negotiated and approved at one of the peaks of the anti-migration narrative globally, with many governments, particularly in the West, espousing openly anti-migration rhetorics for different reasons. And despite all that, thanks to precisely good, sophisticated negotiation conducted by all member countries, we succeeded, despite all those challenges, and maybe because of those challenges, to produce this instrument. This instrument, I think, is playing a very important role in many different ways. It's not a treaty. It's not about being bound by it or not. It's being about being, or is about being, politically committed. And you can see that regardless of what some national governments are doing on migration, many organizations, local governments, mayors, cities have taken, in around the world, have taken the Global Compact as the guiding principles to develop policies regarding migration, including, by the way, in the US. So in that sense, the Global Compact is being very successful because this is an instrument that created all these principles, all these political commitments. It created a systemic logic, if I can use it like that, of the phenomenon, demystified the phenomenon, and proposed alternatives to address it to ensure these three objectives: orderly, regular, and safe. And it's been growing organically. So I think it's very successful. It's slowly growing, being implemented here and there, and we'll see where it goes. But it created order in the debate.
I'm just reflecting now on how we're under a second Trump administration and how we've seen the intensification of blockades towards migration domestically. And you mentioned how the Global Compact has served as a basis for guiding principles on migration, even in the United States. But how have countries, specifically the U.S. under a second Trump administration, aligned or failed to align with key commitments in the agreement?
I'm not so sure they know it exists, the administration. But again, migration, one of the interesting complexities of migration is that national governments are the ones that can open the door or close the door, and that's their prerogative. Migration is probably the only global issue where countries are not willing, for different reasons, to cede an inch of their absolute sovereign right to decide who enters their country and who does not, or under which conditions. So that's a prerogative of the federal government here, or the national governments or federal governments elsewhere. But migration has an enormous, let's say, its reality expresses itself in places, in cities, in little communities, in little towns where migrants are, where local communities are receiving these migrants, where companies are hiring them. So we're in the places where this is in reality expressing itself, and there is where you can see more, less, in some places zero, depending the how they see it, you see a lot of the Global Compact. Is the federal government pursuing it? Again, I'm not even sure they are aware. No? The U.S. administration is pursuing the policy that we know, and that's what it is, but let's see what happens in the future.
No, that really resonates, and it really makes me consider this idea of, or the larger concept of, a rules-based international order, which, for listeners who may not know, is a set of agreed-upon rules for security, cooperation, and for resolving disputes among nations on issues such as trade and governing practices. Now, given the rise of geopolitical tensions and shifts in government throughout the world, especially in the U.S., do you believe that a rules-based international order still exists? And if it doesn't, what does that mean for international law adherence and human rights going forward?
The idea of a rules-based international order basically means that we all share the same planet, countries, and have devised some behavioral rules. What is accepted, what is not accepted. And it's not only security, it's not only human rights, it's on everything. And the more globalized and interdependent the world became, the bigger sense of a collectivity grew, or we have. And the way this collectivity acts, the way we as countries act, that's the idea of rules-based international order. We have rules. We have understandings. We have accepted policies that are collective, and we have to behave or abide by them. In general, I think more or less with enormous imperfections, the system has worked. We have multilateral institutions, cooperation, tons of international law on many things, and countries accepted that these were the rules of the game. I think we are now going through not just change. I think we are going through a true paradigm shift where the system as we understood it, the rules that we understood were the applicable rules, whatever they were, policies, norms, law, hard law, are going to change. And we don't know where or how. Will it survive, if you want to ask? Well, certainly as we know it, probably not. Does this mean that we will have a system without rules? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think the rules are changing. The principles will change. Probably less cooperation. Probably more national interest versus global or collective things. Probably, well, we are seeing, for example, the best example is trade. The free trade as part of precisely this notion of international rules is gone. And I think it's gone for good. I mean, it's finished. Okay, we will adapt and we will create new rules. Now, there will be tariffs and new treaties, etc. I don't like it, but that's the way it's going to be. But there will be a system. In other words, I don't believe that the alternative to what we have because of what is happening is chaos, disorder, or I don't think so. Not that it's going to be better. Eh? That's a different question. But I don't think it's going to be just chaos or disorder.
No, thank you for that response. I want to shift our conversation slightly now to the topic of global health. You were also a co-chair for the creation of the World Health Organization Pandemic Influenza Preparedness Framework after the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, which claimed the lives of over 15,000 people. Drawing on your experience in drafting and implementing this framework, what lessons stand out to you, particularly in light of the COVID-19 pandemic? And where do you believe global cooperation on health governance and pandemic preparedness fell short in that case?
Lessons are many, but the first point I should stress is that health is not just health. I explained myself. Health is development. Health is or means wealth creation. Health means political stability. Health means peace and security. Lack of health is the opposite. Lack of health means lack of prosperity, lack of wealth creation, expanding of inequality, poverty growth instead of poverty reduction. And as we saw with COVID, can produce political instability. So this is to say that we need to approach health not only as health, but as a wide-ranging, absolutely strategic security, the most political, economic, social, and cultural challenge that we may have. Therefore, second point, this is an issue where global governance is not only paramount, it's a sine qua non condition. Because health, as COVID shown and every pandemic has shown, and sadly the next pandemic will show, because there will be more pandemics, viruses, pathogens, move freely in the planet. And this means that the only way we can protect ourselves from these infectious diseases is by making sure that everybody else is protected. If there's one that is not protected, if there's one place where these viruses can come or this bacteria can come, you are exposed and you won't be able to build just a bubble for yourself that will prevent these pathogens from coming through and starting spreading the disease inside your bubble. So regardless of your ideology, regardless of whether you are globalist or nationalist, or regardless of whether you are right, left, liberal, conservative, etc., you need to, countries have understood, if they have not, they need to understand that the only way to protect themselves, the only way to realize their national interest is by creating a robust system of global governance. So that's, to me, these are the most important lessons of what I have done on global health. And what COVID brought to us also proved it sadly many times over. The loss of life, the loss of wealth, the economic pain, and probably, not probably, millions of people, particularly young people that lost school classes, the damage remains huge. So we need to work together.
And obviously we're still reeling from the devastating impacts of COVID-19 around the world, so it would be optimistic at best to hope that this devastating experience could serve as a lesson to prepare for next time. Again, given this catastrophic pandemic, how well prepared do you think we as a country and world are for the next pandemic should one occur? Or do you think we're not prepared unless we have a robust global governance on health, like you had just mentioned?
I think we need, countries are prepared in different ways. And a country like the U.S. has enormous capacity. No? I mean, it's needless to say. Rich countries, wealthy countries in general, are very well prepared because they have resources and they have very robust health systems and they have very robust capacity to reach to people. The challenge is not that. The challenge is that for as much as you may have all that, if there are other countries in the world that don't have that capacity, that don't have functional health systems, that don't have the means to finance, that they don't have access to drugs, medicines, vaccines, all your strength, all your capacity, all your power will not protect you from. So again, the solution is what WHO does and the UN and what everyone has been trying to do. The process I led, it was on influenza, and the processes in WHO that are ongoing precisely on COVID, which is to make sure that we have global systems in place, not only abstract rules, but very clear-cut, well-defined systems of reaction or fall reaction to make sure that as soon as a pathogen, potentially pandemic, is identified anywhere in the world, the global system reacts immediately and can take immediate measures to stop it there. Second, another gigantic challenge that we all have has to do with vaccines. So again, great, not only great, exceptional that the US or Europe have the capacity to create and develop these vaccines. And COVID proved that through intelligence, technology, and very robust financing, the pharma came up extremely fast with the appropriate vaccines. But the challenge is, how do you make sure that they become available to the whole planet, which it didn't happen? So all these are the challenges that show that, again, we need stronger global rules, principles, collective policies that are accepted, understood, embraced, and that we cooperate. And that we help poor countries to have the capacities they need to be better prepared for the future, not only for themselves, but for ourselves.
No, I agree. I do believe that we need stronger global rules and senses of cooperation so that these levels of, or these catastrophic levels that impacted so many lives can be prevented in the future. I wanted to shift now slightly to North American bilateral and intergovernmental dynamics, specifically from the United States perspective. Last year, the Mexican government paused its relationship with the U.S. and Canadian embassies in the country. And I wanted to get your opinion on how have presidents how have President Trump's domestic policies, such as stricter migration enforcement and economic protectionism, affected American and Mexican diplomatic efforts?
Listen, this thing of pausing the relationship, if I may say, was don't push me to say what it was. Ignore it. It was just one of these things that happened in life and politics. So, it was nothing because it didn't mean anything. What if you want to think of the U.S.-Mexico relationship, and let's add Canada here, because what has happened over the last almost four decades is a very strong process of integration among the three countries, or between the three countries. All this is important to understand before we get into what's happening now. The three countries are, yes, the U.S., there is a huge asymmetry between the U.S. and then Mexico and Canada on each side. The U.S. is many times bigger, many times more powerful, is what it is. And Mexico and Canada are what they are. However, despite that, there is enormous integration and interdependence. Economically, and increasingly particularly with Mexico, socially, culturally, etc. For your audience, Mexico is the first trading partner of the U.S. Canada is the second trading partner of the U.S., ahead of China. The millions is not only about the consumers in the U.S., it's the millions of jobs in the U.S., that depend on this trade with Mexico and Canada. Second, this economic integration evolved not only to or from selling to each other without trade barriers, without tariffs and taxes, etc., freely, to jointly produce things. So the complexity and the success of this economic integration is that the three countries have developed a collective joint production base. To give you an idea, whatever is, let's say, cars in Mexico that come out from a Mexican factory or cars that come out from a U.S. factory, and the same applies between Canada and the U.S., cross the border an average of seven times before it was a finished product. This is just to explain the complexity. Second reality, and this is the case of Mexico, migration. Migration is an enormous complex phenomenon. The U.S. is the most or the first magnet for migrants around the world by far. And Mexico happens to be next to it, which means that Mexico became decades ago, the largest migration corridor in the planet. Not with Mexicans or because of Mexicans, but because everybody else around the world went or have tried to come to the U.S. through Mexico. In fact, Mexican migration to the U.S. became what is called or reached what is called net zero 10 years ago, meaning more people returned to Mexico than people coming to the U.S. So Mexicans coming went down and Mexicans returning went up. This has changed, but fundamentally is that. But people from other 90 nationalities go through Mexico to come to the U.S. So to your point, President Trump, Mexico, President Sheinbaum, etc. On migration first, I think that it's an area where Mexico and the U.S. see eye to eye for different reasons, different ideology, different motivations, and different ways. But see eye to eye in the sense that uncontrolled, massive numbers of migration is not good for the U.S., is not good for Mexico, and is not good for the migrants. It's dangerous, it's complex. Mexico doesn't have the capacity. Mexican institutions can't cope with these hundreds of thousands of migrants every year that no longer are coming. Organized crime was having a field day, almost like a picnic, with trafficking people. So it's bad. So in that sense, both countries have worked to reduce it. Different ways, but we have worked to reduce it. And I think it is now on a fairly manageable way. You can argue different things politically, ideologically from different ways. But it's very important that it's done. This doesn't mean that we have to do this without absolutely ensuring the protection of human rights of migrants and doing everything under the law, due process of law, and in a humanitarian way. So I think that, back to your question, Mexico-US, President Trump, I think on that there is clarity. And you don't hear President Trump saying things on Mexican migration. Trade is more complex. First, we need to understand that the era of free trade that lasted 7 decades is gone. Now we are in a new paradigm, as I was saying before. And this new paradigm is of not free trade. It's a trade with barriers and trade with taxes and tariffs. The complexity between, the advantage and complexity between Canada, US, and Mexico is that we have the USMCA, previously known as NAFTA, which is a very extensive, very complex, and very important free trade treaty between the three countries. That was renewed and renegotiated, pushed by the first Trump administration, and signed by President Trump in his first administration. This treaty exempts from tariffs more or less 80% of products that come to the US from Mexico or from Canada, and that stays in place. There are exceptions now that we are negotiating with the US, or Mexico is negotiating with the US and Canada too, which is how much tariffs on car industries and under which conditions, how much tariffs on steel and aluminum under which conditions. These are things that are not good. We would like not to have them, but they are there. So it's being negotiated and some agreement will be reached. There will be tariffs on some products, and that's the way it's going to be. However, every statistic, every analysis that you see keeps showing that since this is global, regardless of the tariffs finally imposed on every country, Mexico and Canada will continue having an enormous trade advantage versus the other countries. The average tariff today is more or less 13-14% to come to the US. The tariffs average for Canada and Mexico are more or less 6-7%. So it's very complex. But we are dealing with it, and I think it will be dealt with successfully.
No, thank you for that thoughtful response. Especially, I was going to ask you about NAFTA or the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement now. And you mentioned Trump and his policies with Canada and Mexico during his first administration. But given now, with the escalation in tariffs on both countries, how do you think this second Trump administration has impacted existing doctrines like the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement that are aimed at consolidating resources and collaboration? I know that you mentioned that Mexico and Canada have the advantage, but are there any impacts that you may have not mentioned?
Of course, I think the most, I wouldn't see it in terms of doctrines. I will see it in terms of objectives. And what is clear is, and the most fundamental change, is the notion of North America. The casualty of all this is the idea of North America. Since early 1990s, as I was saying, we began a trilateral process of not only integration, but the creation, if you like, of the notion of North America as a region, integrated with three countries that, despite some very structural differences between the three, including the enormous asymmetry of the US, would pursue this integration, and not only in trade, not only economically, but in an enormous number or quantity of different issues. And this had been pursued even through the first President Trump administration, and then with far more intensity during the Biden administration. But Bush, Clinton, Obama, all decades of this. The casualty today of all of the change in the US is precisely this. There's no longer a North America as a region. There is no longer a North America as a narrative, and there are no longer efforts to pursue this integration. And I think that's a very big casualty. This is not to say, however, that this is changing the integration itself, because the three countries, for different reasons, many of which I have tried to explain, are like Siamese's that shared organs, vital organs that you cannot unwind. So supply chains will continue, even if there are tariffs. Energy integration in different ways will continue. Health security will remain a challenge. that we will have to work together. Migration, we will have to keep working together. Organized crime, we will have to keep working together. And then the other extremely powerful integration engine is culture. We all see the enormous influence, and it's natural to say the enormous influence of the American culture in the whole planet, imagine in Canada or in Mexico also. But it's equally clear and important to say that there is also this influence in the opposite direction. The Mexican culture is a very powerful culture. Mexico is a civilization with a gigantic diaspora here, 38 million, who is also penetrating the U.S. So integration will remain. The narrative will change. And some specific aspects will be different, like tariffs or the management of the border, etc. But overall, I don't see much fundamental change in that. Diplomatically, yes, it poses totally different challenges, but that's what diplomacy is all about.
You mentioned that integration will remain. And I know that at the same time, you said that there is no more North America as a narrative or integration. So at least from the North America region, how should diplomatic efforts adapt to maintain trust and collaboration in an increasingly fragmented global environment that the North American region is a part of?
Listen, first, the three countries need to keep working. The level of communication, at least between Mexico and the U.S., but certainly Canada and the U.S., and increasingly Canada and Mexico, is very high. So Mexican officials, U.S. officials, Canadian officials, I can tell you, they are on daily contact. That's diplomacy, precisely. Operating and working with the U.S. administration, persuading, adapting, accommodating, changing, counter-proposing, etc., etc., but it's happening. Second, a very interesting thing to see in the future, and it'll be a very interesting equation or challenge for the three countries, diplomatically, if you want to see it, to use that word, is that one of the important aspects of the North American integration was what would this mean geopolitically if an integrated North America would have a different geopolitical effect than a non-integrated North America. And this is a tricky question because, again, the U.S. is too big. Nevertheless, on many aspects, the North American integration was a very positive in broader geopolitical terms, in terms of Latin America, Canada in NATO, on health, that is also geopolitical, on many issues, energy, etc. So now the challenge is going to be, the narrative of North America is gone. As I said, the integration is not. Will North American efforts in practice to operate together abroad will also disappear? I think in the short term, yes, simply because the narratives do not coincide. But increasingly, the level of the water will reach or will come back to a certain level where the three countries will have to keep working together abroad. I was ambassador of Mexico to the UN during the first Trump administration. My counterpart and very dear friend was Ambassador Nikki Haley. We had very different points of view. And Canada, another dear friend, Ambassador Marc-André Blanchard. And despite of what was happening between Mexico City, Ottawa, and Washington, despite the narratives, despite the anti-UN narrative, despite the anti-migration narrative, and all the narratives that you know, the three countries through us managed to work very constructively towards the same ends, which is having as consolidated as possible North America also operating in some areas globally. In others, it's impossible because we see things differently, fundamentally different, but in many it can. So let's see where the level adjusts. There will be an adjustment phase, which is now. I don't think it is possible to cooperate now. The focus is somewhere else, etc. The UN is being challenged, etc. But at some point, I think, let's say, reality will impose itself.
I agree. I do think that reality will make itself known, and then different countries will have to gather around that and then hopefully integrate further. To wrap up our conversation and to look to the future, what do you see as the most pressing challenge to effective global governance now and in the future?
the U.S. because the U.S. has been the guarantor of the system. We may like it, we may not, you can see it ideologically, any way you want to see it. It's a factual reality. So the guarantor of the system, the country that led the creation of the system, and the country that, despite what many people believe, and despite many exceptions, well-known exceptions, is a country that abided by the rules, followed the rules. Again, there were exceptions, and there are areas more polemic. But in general terms, it did. So the biggest challenge is that this country has a fundamental change of perception, a fundamental change of perception of the world, of itself, of its role, of the rules, of the institutions. So that's not just a challenge. It's a massive challenge coming, as I said, from an, in my view at least, absolute paradigmatic change. Where are we going? I don't know. The other thing that one has to understand in this world of politics, of foreign policy, of diplomacy, negotiations, of life in general, is that uncertainty is far more present than we would like it to be. So, uncertainty today is the rule. It can go either way. And it'll be for great diplomats, it'll be for great statesmen to lead this transformation to a good port or harbor. And on this, it's going to take great diplomacy, great diplomats, and great statesmen to work with the U.S. and help the U.S., this massive power, to move in a direction that is good for everyone, including, of course, the U.S. That's a big challenge.
No, I agree. And given your experience and expertise as a Mexican diplomat, what might the role of Mexico be in shaping global solutions in the near future?
Mexico is a country that, amongst its many characteristics, has one leg in the developing world, one leg in the developed world. It's Latin American and is North American. Has the Pacific, has the Atlantic. It's a country of many multiple belongings. And most importantly, are being neighbors to the U.S. shaped the international persona and objectives of Mexico. And it's also a big country. It's a country of 130 million people, 10th largest economy in the world, and one of the 10, 12 largest countries in the world, almost on any metric you want to choose. So because of this multiplicity of belongings, together with its important size, and having the U.S. next door, or being the next door to the U.S., we became a country with an incredible capacity, I have to say, that not many countries have, to be always in the middle, pulling together different sides of the debate. Mexico became not only a natural, but also a sought-after bridge, a country that could genuinely understand the needs, the reasoning, the thinking, the views of the West, the developed West, rich countries, and also that could understand perfectly well the challenges and needs of developing countries. And modestly aside, with good diplomacy. So we always did that. As we grew, we became also increasingly systemic, meaning that whatever happened in Mexico had a broader impact, much more with integration to the U.S. The challenge that we have today is that that role is more or less at stake, not because of the world, but because of Mexico itself. Because Mexico, since 2018, is experiencing its own paradigm shift internally. We are going through, in many ways, a regime change democratically. President López Obrador first, and now President Sheinbaum. So in this readjusting of Mexico internally, in this transformation, which is very radical, radical in the sense that is very important, is not a minor transformation, but a fundamental transformation. Mexico will have, and it's very ideological too, Mexico will have to redefine its role globally. And so far, it's too busy in its internal transformation and too busy with the U.S. So again, it'll take time for the country to settle. And for the country to rethink whatever we need to rethink, how we are going to operate globally. Not clear yet at all. So we moved from being, again, modesty aside, a crucial global actor to more introvert, if you like, focused in ourselves, or the country's focus in itself, in a massive transformation, and then the US. So we'll see. I hope we come back to where we were, but let's see.
Yeah. Us today, it has Pleasure. Been my privilege to interview you. This has been a fascinating discussion. I know that I learned so much, and I'm sure that the listeners did as well.
Happy to do it. Always happy to interact with the students. You are all very bright, so I'm very happy to do it.
Thank you for joining us on Small World, Big Problems. We hope you found our discussion as insightful as I did. If you're interested in more discussions on global diplomacy and governance-related topics, please subscribe to the show on whichever platform you get your podcasts. This episode was edited by Vishal Gogasetti, and this has been a production of the Johns Hopkins SAIS Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C.